Welcome to Stargate SG Fun, a podcast where we discuss the original Stargate SG-1 series, some episodes in deep dives and some in shorter reactions. Today we're going to be discussing four episodes from Season 3. I'm Trishy Mattson.
I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm David Schaub.
And today we're going to start off with Season 3, Episode 5, Learning Curve. David, tell us what's happening.
On Orban, Jackson does archaeology with lots of child labor. Foreshadowing. In SGC, an 11-year-old Marin teaches Carter how to build an Aquia reactor after confusion about what teaching is. Jackson and Teal'c talk to another 11-year-old, Toman, on Orban. Carter and O'Neill try to explain what school and fun is to Marin. SGC learns that Marin's knowledge is due to millions of nanites in her brain. Toman disappears, and the mystery of the Avarium is revealed. The kids will have their brains sucked out by the time they turn 12, making Toman infant-like. O'Neill is not impressed, and kidnaps Marin to show her how Earth kids learn and paint at Cassandra's old elementary school, but Marin insists on going home. SG-1 doesn't stop Orban's practices, but through Marin they do teach them new opportunities.
Right. Well, this episode is not super important to the series arc, although it is actually mentioned later, glancingly. But I think it's a good episode, a well-written episode. And I was really wondering, David, as a parent, how much it hit you in the feels.
As a parent, I do find, this is the only thing I've found from having kids, is there is now media I cannot consume. Because it will hurt too much. Like, I will never watch Grave of the Fireflies again. And that's okay. And therefore, I think that it is interesting sometimes seeing these children in danger or risk situations. But this one is so strange, and I'm impressed by it, because the show just refuses to entirely say that Orban is wrong. Like, Kirk doesn't get to say your civilization is wrong and breaks it. They don't quite do that. They pull that punch and it's like, yeah, but having that husk of your child just rotting in a room is really sad. So it plays it, I think, amazingly well.
Good. Yeah, I think it's very well written. How about you, Andrew?
Well, it's funny, right? Because they had this idea, right, where, hey, we're going to have this civilization which has this very different setup than ours, you know, so obviously different that, you know, you can have conflicts about it. But the idea itself is ridiculous, right? Like, it doesn't work to basically throw away, like, a whole bunch of children every year to do learning in this fashion. You can't run a civilization this way. There's also a bunch of little things about, you know, the fact that they don't know what learning is. But then they also say elsewhere that the Uron children are not all of the children of this civilization. There's a whole bunch of other children that have to learn the normal way, or they just wouldn't be able to function because they're not Uron.
No. They do cover that. So what they say is that there's basically two divisions of learning. There's everyone else, and they get just enough nanites to be sort of capable in society in general. And like the dad,
sort of like passing on RNA or something.
Well, basically, but they basically do. I would say, like, the dad got an equivalent of a high school education, and that's the amount of nanites they put into them. So, like, everyone in the society gets enough nanites to reach sort of a high school level, and they then go their entire life with that. And that's sort of learning version one. And that's like, okay, weird. The other one is these kids where they dump tons and tons of nanites into them and make them super geniuses. But you are correct. It still makes no sense. Like, it's sci-fi. It's a premise. But it makes no sense.
Yeah, not only that, but we find out that this tech was only invented 49 years ago.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah.
I find it very hard to believe that all trace of learning the old-fashioned way and having fun for kids would have disappeared in just 49 years. That's well, I guess it's four generations of Urone, but only a couple of generations of non-Urone. And, you know, unless all the parents... We never saw any old people in this episode. Maybe they all die when they're 40 or 50 or something like that.
They just killed all their old people when they switched over. Yeah. Yeah, there would still be people alive.
But wouldn't there have been a few refuseniks on the edges of society who said, I'm not putting that stuff in my kid's bloodstream? It does seem slightly suspect as for how it would all work. But I enjoyed it. If you don't if you don't scrutinize it too hard, it's still an interesting concept.
Yeah.
It's hard. I think there generally was a time compression problem in the storyline.
Right.
And you can see why they needed to do it. Like, one, yes, they should have been learning the old-fashioned way 500 years ago, not 50. Just a bad little bit of scripting there.
Right.
That's ridiculous. But the other one is the efficiency of it is just so horrifying to me. Because effectively, what it sounds like is that they inject all these nanites into these super kids, basically build them up for about a decade. They then use them in their peak potential for about, 2 years, and then they have to start all over again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, there's no reason they needed to re-ingest the information that quickly. They just needed it because they needed the tweens to not even become teenagers before they got their brain sucked. And it's like...
I'm assuming puberty does something to mess up the neural structures, and so that's why they have to have it done at 12.
But yeah, it just makes the compression not make any sense, but it's necessary for the story. And like, the reality is, yeah, the premise makes no sense, and with sci-fi I'm always willing to say, okay, the premise makes no sense, but how well did they do it?
Yeah.
And I think this episode does the premise really well, but the premise is dumb.
Well, how many episodes can you say that about?
It's Stargate. Well,
the meat of this episode is sort of those arguments between what's his name? The guy,
Kalen,
and like O'Neill, or even like Teal'c or Daniel, where they kind of are like, you know, how can you do this to your kids? And he's like, oh no, here are the benefits of it. And even like, you know, Marin herself is kind of like arguing for why this should be this way. And sort of the back and forth between those things, that sort of philosophical argument of how should you deal with the trade-offs of civilization. Yeah, that's the meat of this episode, whether or not the system actually makes any sense or not. And I do think that was handled, yeah, as you said, that was handled pretty well.
Yeah.
So yeah, overall, this episode was a success, definitely.
I did find it a really chilling moment when Teal'c is insisting, you know, where is Toman? And eventually Kalen points to his temple and says, my son is here now, smiling. And, you know, yeah, you got one of the nanocytes from your son. Great. I thought that was an effectively chilling moment. But I also liked Kalen's angry arguments back. You claim to love knowledge, yet when you find something you don't like, you demand that we change to please you. And there was certainly some justification in his viewpoint there. And it didn't look like they had a lot of weapons or anything to force their point that, you know, give us Marin back. But Kalen, for a never educated except through nanocytes guy, he seemed to be a pretty good advocate for his people. And Marin had certainly learned the values of her society. Now, I'm not an advocate of that extreme of societal self-sacrifice, especially when, until SGC came, it seems like they didn't even really know about the gold threat. So why would they be so self-sacrificial of their culture? But yeah, I did like that Kalen got to argue his point, and Marin was eventually allowed to make her own choice. And it did turn out that that choice affected her society and allowed play to happen. Although, how did the past Urones get this sense of play? Because it's been stated in the episode that they can't learn anymore from the nanocyte being passed on.
Yeah.
But
did the other, did the non-Uronians just get taught how to teach and play, and they taught and played the past Urones the traditional way?
Yeah, the implication is that the everyone who received their nanites changed their behavior, and the super kids were just then started to be being treated differently, and that was the difference. And I would assume that not all of those kids that we see at the end are kids that have had the brain sucked. maybe some of those are also just kids of that civilization who just received one of those nanites. So it's not super clear who is and isn't of which class of learner.
Right.
Okay.
But yeah, they play a little loose with that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't think they implied that the sense of learning was implanted into the kids that had their brain sucked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think the what they wanted at the end of this episode was to show a bunch of kids playing
right
when they hadn't been playing before. Mm-hmm. And the episode doesn't care that much exactly how that happened, except that it obviously came from Jack, right? That's what they care about. They don't care about explaining how the Urone kids got it. You know, maybe it was by being taught it by everyone else, like by regular teaching. Maybe it was by a nanite. They don't need to be consistent about it, right? Because what they wanted to do was show that scene and show, you know, Marin drawing on the wall, mm-hmm. right? And Marin wouldn't have gotten a nanite. Like, how would she remember, right? She gave her nanites to everybody else. Yeah, it doesn't matter, right? We want to have that.
Yeah, also, we don't know how much time passed between Marin going back.
Yeah, definitely.
That's true as well, yeah.
And Kaelin saying, hey, come for a visit, we're all happy now.
I found it really interesting at the end because this is, of more than almost any episode, is like an epilogue. Mm-hmm. Like, the episode effectively ended, and, you know, you could have just had it end kind of sad.
Yes.
And then they just,
yep.
Some amount of time passes, mm-hmm. and then there's this epilogue which says, yeah, well, we did some good, too. We changed them a little bit. We didn't reverse their society. They're still brain-sucking 12-year-olds, but hey, this little thing changed a little. And I was... amazed by that epilogue. I did not expect it when watching it. And that surprised me.
So I do have some sort of incidental little notes for the end here. They mentioned the nanocytes from Brief Candle. So I thought that was a fun callback.
Right. Nice callback. They're all absolutely horrified when Dr. Janet Fraser sees nanocytes right. in the blood, because this is the only experience they've had of nanocytes being used by an evil Gould for accelerated aging.
And you mean this is still evil, but, you know, sort of evil. But yeah, like, nanocytes are not all one thing, which, you know, they should have known because they're scientists, but okay. The other fun one was the sex joke.
Oh, yes.
Where Carter is talking with Marin and is like, half the interesting things in my life didn't happen until I turned 15. And Marin's like, what kind of interesting things? Stuff. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's that joke. That's what they're... And then... speaking of that sort of thing, Mrs. Struble, mm-hmm. the teacher, seemed really happy to see Jack. I'm just saying, like, you know, very, very happy to see him. And, you know, there could be...
Yeah, I do appreciate that they called back Cassandra,
yes.
who we don't get to see on screen, but at least it's nice for the writers to acknowledge that she still exists and is presumably happy.
Some writer.
Right.
Some writer is so proud that they needed, like, how do we put Marin in a school? Wait a second, Jack had taken them to a school. Why in the world would Jack take anyone to a school? Cassandra went to school.
Yeah, it was clever.
I thought that was clever. A very clever bit of world building. There's a lot of nice, subtle world building in here and connections. The connection to Cassandra is nice. What might be an important thing, which is SGC now knows how to make Nakoda reactors, sounds really cool. It's underplayed, and, like, who knows? Obviously, this is going to come up again, but it's like, and it's kind of damaged in the next episode, but we'll get there. But it's like, that's just a nice touch bit of world building. That's like, there is technological improvement in the SGC's capability in this episode, and it's not really part of the episode, but it plays into it beautifully. Like, there's just lots of very nice world building steps.
One point that I really questioned, though, was these are apparently descendants of Teotihuacan, a great city that predated the Aztecs, but everybody is blonde, or at least sandy-haired. I don't know how that happened.
It's super whitewashed.
Yes, super.
That's just the reality. It's just super whitewashed, and that kind of sucks.
And a thread that is left dangling is that Daniel sees evidence that the Gould were here several hundred years ago, and we don't know why they left.
Yep.
The Orbans don't know about the Gould at all, so... But there was an evidence left in a stone carving that the Gould were here. So we don't know either why they were here, how long they were here, or why they left. And I don't know that this is ever picked up again.
There's an aspect of the story structure of this episode that is really strong. Like, they take... it's about a knowledge transfer between these two civilizations, and then there's an A and a B plot, which of course are connected, but also they split the team, and their stories are going on in parallel as the mystery is revealed on both planets. And like all of that is really nice, and it's also aligned with Jackson doing archaeology and slowly revealing this mural mosaic thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing I really kind of wanted at the end was showing us the darn mosaic.
Yeah.
Like there's the one reveal where like there's some type of Jaffa guard like symbolism going on in the...
Mm-hmm.
But they don't even... But it looks like it's like in the plaster of what was covering the mosaic. They just maybe didn't get around to really finishing the mosaic. And I really wanted to see the mosaic at the end of the episode. And I was a little disappointed at that.
Well, the inference, or maybe Daniel states it, is that the Orbanians came here from Teotihuacan, you know, millennia ago. And that the Gould probably destroyed that great city back then. So maybe... The fragment of a carving here that implies a Jaffa, maybe that's just a 1,000-year-old memory, or 2,000-year-old, however old it is.
And it, yeah.
From the past civilization.
And it is absolutely possible that the Gould brought other people from other places on the planet here in the last thousands of years. And they just wouldn't know that. So yeah, there's aspects of the mystery box that I think maybe could have also done some explanation, but they just didn't get around to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah.
Also, we find out something we probably could have guessed before, that Jack O'Neill doesn't like people all that much. Dogs are my favorite people, he says.
I do think if you trace through the plot, you trace through what they talk about, I think the reason why there are those aspects of their background are solely because they want Tommen to have to be like, oh, I need to be sort of reaped now. I need to have my avarium because we need to know about the Gould. And there, and once Tommen is sort of handled in that way, then that triggers, you know, Teal'c saying, well, where is he? And advances the plot. I think that's the only reason they did that. Like, the reason the Gould are a threat to these people are solely to drive that aspect of the plot, and for no other reason. The show does not care about the thing we just talked, you know, a couple minutes ago. We are thinking about it a lot more than they ever did, which is a pattern with this show.
I think they actually did in this case. Like, I think there's so much work in the writing. Like, this is the thing where I find Stargate episodes, there's the ones that are written carefully and the ones that aren't. This was written pretty carefully. I think someone did think about it.
Yes.
I expect there just wasn't time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It wasn't their focus.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although I actually noticed, like, Daniel Jackson is, like, tracing, like, a red line or something, a squiggly red line for, like, a couple of seconds. And I'm like, why are you, you know, what is the point of doing that? Like, it was just sort of funny that, like, that was sort of, like, the introductory thing that he was doing to start off the scene. And they never come back to it, and they never explain what he was doing. You know, it's just kind of funny to me. They're like, you know what? Nope, that's never going to get really explained what he was doing or what it means or anything else. So, yeah.
All right, shall we move on?
I have a couple of little items.
Okay.
I wanted to toss out. This show periodically really likes throwing children actors into the show.
Yeah.
And again, I'd like to give credit to the two actors for Marin and Tobin. I think did a really great job. Like, and maybe they were, it's an easier role to play someone stranger and not kid-like. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe that is easier in this case. But I just want to give a call out that the actors, I think, did a really great job of that. And Maren, I think, does a really great job of that.
Yep.
Similar to that, there's something which I don't think really is a fair thing to attack a 90s show for, but in the painting scene where O'Neill is the every person and is telling Maren that to paint the way that he wants her to paint. now maybe I'm coming back as a parent thing, but this is what it looks like when neurotypical adults are pressuring neurodivergent children to act in a specific way.
Yeah.
In any modern viewing, someone's going to interpret Maren's behavior in a somewhat neurodivergent way. To be fair, she has nanites in her brain. So very functional cause in this episode, but it almost there's a touch of cruelty to the painting scene where he's basically saying, no, I need you to do this my way, not your way.
Yep.
And there's some educational value, there's some pushing people on their boundaries a bit, but that read differently to me now than it would have in the 90s.
Yes.
Which I thought was an interesting way, modern view of an older show.
Yeah, good point.
Yep.
I really did quite like O'Neill, when pushed, fully admits that he is not as smart as the scientists. Like, he initially considers pushing back and is like, nah, I got nothing in this.
He could have.
I don't need to prop myself up.
He could have argued, I'm smart in different ways. I have better technical awareness, you know, but.
He almost said it, and the writer said, nah, why have O'Neill be just a little, sound a bit like a jerk there. And again, O'Neill in a lot of these episodes is not driven by his ego very much, and it shows really nicely in some of the episodes.
Yeah, he realized that he did not need to win this argument, and if she wanted to think of him as less smart, that's okay.
And then it was capped with the Carter Wonderful line regarding trying to build the generator and going over specs and doing sciencey stuff. And Carter says, sounds like fun to me.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So it's a great little bit there.
Right. And I like the point of Carter saying, you know, no, don't tell me the answer. Let me figure it out for myself, because it's so much more satisfying when you figure out how to do something yourself. And I was thinking of that in relation to ChatGPT and similar, quote, AIs that are really large language models, where, you know, so many kids these days are turning in homework assignments and stuff that they've just asked the computer what to say instead of learning the very valuable skill of figuring out how to organize your thoughts and put them into words.
The last one thing I'd like to call out is, I'm assuming the reversing the polarity reference is a Doctor Who reference. And always nice to see that thrown in. I'm assuming that was intentional.
Right.
But yeah, it was a good episode.
Yep. All right. And next up, we have the next episode, episode 6, Point of View. David, please take it away.
A multiverse mirror Carter and Kowalski from a Gwould-invaded Earth show up in Area 51. They hope to stay at SGC, but Mirror Carter will die if she stays, for Stargate science reasons. Mirror Carter and Kowalski plan to return to their reality and call the Asgard for help. The Carters science up an 8th Chevron power generator. SG-1, except for Carter, goes to the mirror reality, find a mirror Teal'c, who Teal'c quickly kills, and a mirror Apophis in the SGA. They sneak around, free Mirror Hammond, Mirror Carter gates to the Asgards, but SG-1 is captured and Mirror Hammond is killed. The Asgards show up, we don't get to see them, revive Mirror Hammond, capture Apophis and scare the Gwould away. O'Neill loves these guys. Mirror Carter kisses O'Neill goodbye.
Yep. This is another episode that I don't think is hugely important to the arc, although, you know, Sam learns some more science, which will be helpful eventually, but I think it's a well-written episode, an episode with a lot of good emotional beats, And there are a lot of moments I really appreciate in it.
The shippers must have loved this episode.
Oh, yeah. Andrew?
Yeah, I often talk in these episodes about what's the heart of the episode, right? Like, what did they write? What did they come up with this episode for? And I do think the scene with Carter and O'Neill, that's just Samantha and O'Neill, was the heart of this episode. That's what they wanted to show in this episode. The rest of it was kind of the scaffolding around that, it feels like, in a lot of ways. You know, and I think we know Richard Dean Anderson can act, right? I think, what is her name?
Amanda Tapping.
Amanda Tapping. I have talked about how sort of the other actors on this are not necessarily the kind, like they couldn't do the kind of nuance you get in the best of sort of the golden age of television shows that we've gotten in the last decade or so. But she can... she can cry. She can show sort of that kind of sadness pretty well. We know the Daniel Jackson character can chew the scenery, and we know she can kind of do these sorts of scenes. She's got some emotional scenes. And so I think this was a good fit for the actors.
I don't think we know how good these actors are because they're not being asked to do the kind of golden age acting that we see in current shows.
Okay. That's true. I think we kind of see, I will have more to say about that the further we go in seasons, I think. But yeah, I think that, like, those scenes, the scenes with her in the strangely dim room of her sort of, you know, guest room in the SGC, you know, her and O'Neill talking, you know, they wrote that pretty well. They acted that pretty well. I do think it was sort of melodrama rather than drama, right? They weren't going for deep nuance. They were going for pathos. But I think they made it, right, in terms of a fun melodrama for this and seeing how all this stuff would work out with these very different people. That was fun. We got to see that. I think one of my notes here says, Jack continues to be very dumb this episode. I do think that season three is where we start to lose any sense that Jack is in any way a smart guy, which we kind of saw in earlier seasons. You know, he was good in astronomy. He was more well-rounded in previous seasons when they weren't going for this broad humor that they started going for in this season. And I think this idea that, well, Jack's the dumb one and Carter is the super smart one who can do anything science-wise is cartoonish, but I think this season kind of starts that in earnest and it doesn't end. So that's, you know, I do wish they hadn't done that. I wish they'd left these characters a little more rounded, but this is what we get.
I don't know. To me, it seemed like Jack was being defensively presenting obtuseness. I think he was trying not to get the hints and points that people kept trying to shove onto him because he didn't want to deal. I mean, emotional IQ, very low, I agree. But I think maybe Jack was doing that deliberately.
It's always very hard to tell sometimes with Jack. Like, he is self-effacing occasionally, and he is very supportive of the people around him. And from a sort of Doyleist perspective, the show wants to give space to the other characters. So, like, the doctors and scientists are really very central to how the stories in this show work. And you want to give them that space, and it makes it a little more stronger of an ensemble, and it makes Jack less of a jerk if he is sort of always giving space to others around him. So, like, I agree that they play it up, but sometimes I think Jack is playing it up, but it's a very fine line, and it's hard to tell always what the actors and what the writers are trying to do from scene to scene.
I would disagree. I think it's played so broadly that I don't think it's a fine line at all. But we can agree to disagree. That's what we're here for.
It's a tricky, like, we were seeing that strong emotional situation. But, of course, this is a sci-fi show, and you have this premise which is challenging because the emotions are entirely asymmetrical. And it's like, that is a hard – I'll respect that that's kind of a hard thing to act because it's just a very convoluted situation. in some regards, I think it came down to the editing, and the editors kind of had to hold it together. I think this show does a very good job of very quickly showing you reaction shots constantly between O'Neill and Carter. Because you're right, that is the heart of this episode, is this alt version, shipping version of the show, which didn't go that well, but hey. And I think that is... wasn't interesting that this to see. I think they even pointed out, like, some of it might just be because it's unethical or and against the rules.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was played, I think, reasonably well. I really, really love the very quick shots where we see Carter figuring out that there was the relationship between her and O'Neill, and you get her reaction and O'Neill's reaction, and then her reaction to O'Neill, and then O'Neill's reaction. Like, there's some very nice editing to hold that together.
Yes.
But it's just a weird situation. It's hard to wrap our heads around sometimes what that might look like.
Yeah, I also liked some of the emotional beats with Kowalski, although they were muted. I tend to believe that this Kowalski is more than half in love with his best friend's wife. And, you know, wants the best for her, regardless. But, you know, he could have stayed very safely in our Stargate universe reality and not gone back, because his double here was dead. So he could have stayed, probably without any negative consequences, except that, of course, he wasn't going to let Dr. Carter go back off by herself. And I liked that. And I liked him needling Jack a little bit until Jack finally says, do you understand what a secret, quiet mission, what silence is? I liked that. So, yeah, I was pleased with the acting and the emotional beats in this episode. I did when Jack came out of the room after Dr. Carter was crying and they had their talk where she basically asked him to stay the night, he leaves and immediately sees Major Carter and he asks, how are you doing? And she says, do you have a couple of hours? And he hesitates and says, okay, which is very out of character for him. Very. And she says, that was the answer. I just thought that was a good character moment between our Sam and him.
And you know that Sam is reviewing that conversation the next day when she finds out the context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also noticed the look that the airwoman guarding the door gave Jack as he left. And I wondered how long he had been in there. And when we see Jack leaving the room, Sam's lying down in the bed. And I couldn't tell. I rewatched several times. I couldn't tell if she was wearing any clothes or not. You just basically saw her hair.
I think this show definitely wanted it to be unclear and ambiguous whether or not he slept with her.
Yep.
And I don't know what they'd prefer the audience to think, but they absolutely played it off ambiguously. And it's like, I guess everyone viewing gets to come up with their own conclusion.
Yeah, that's got to have been deliberate, the way they framed him leaving the room without ever actually showing anything but her hair.
I honestly think, given the conversation, the stilted conversation he has with Major Carter right afterwards, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think it quite follows.
No.
But they definitely wanted to leave it a touch ambiguous.
They did. But yeah, Jack was saying the right things in the conversation. He was definitely not jumping at the opportunity that Dr. Carter offered him. He was acknowledging that she's been through a lot of trauma, and this is probably trauma talking. So yeah, I thought that was well done, and I'm pleased with the ambiguity that they left us with. Let's see. Besides the emotional beats in this story, there was something else. Oh, yeah. When Teal'c straight up kills other Teal'c instead of zatting him or trying to convert him to their cause. And he says, as I said, O'Neill, ours is the only reality of consequence, which is rather cold.
Rather, yes.
What did y'all think of that?
I think he did try and convert him. He gave Mir Teal'c about 3 seconds to convert.
True.
that was the opportunity he was willing to give. As like, wow, that is cold. I don't know if I don't think I want Teal'c to control the multiverse.
No, definitely not. I mean, sorry, Andrew?
Well, I think with Teal'c, they're like, well, we need to give him an interesting aspect of this episode, but we're still not willing to give him an actual ton of lines or space. So we'll give him this weird attitude towards multiple timelines in order to give him something to do. That's my theory about what they were doing with that. Like, they wanted to give him something, but they didn't want to give him a lot. So, okay, here's the thing that they could do.
Well, Kowalski ate a lot of what might have been Teal'c's space in this episode.
You know, if this is the only reality of consequence, you know, that means they don't care at all what happens to Dr. Carter back in this universe. Or at least Teal'c doesn't care, although he cared enough to go on the mission, to volunteer for the mission. So,
right?
thinking there seems a little confused. It was almost like he wanted to just kill himself. He could perfectly well have zatted other Teal'c, and he just chose not to do. So that was, you know, it didn't seem wrong to me, but it was, it did take me aback a little bit.
Yep.
Oh, and also, I really liked the genre joke that in this mirror universe, both other Teal'c and other Apophis had beards.
Yep. And they made reference to it. They noted the cliches.
Yes.
Like they absolutely know they're aping Mirror Mirror here. Yep.
And, absolutely.
They were going to tell the audience, yeah, we're aping Mirror Mirror. So what? Watch us.
When I did, like, you know, we got the Kowalski actor back. We got the Apophis actor back. I think Kowalski got the better end of the deal. He got to actually go to Moore and be his character and inhabit his character. Poor Apophis didn't really get to do too much other than really just the same beats that he's done before and sort of limited versions of, you know, that actor is great at chewing the scenery. He didn't get that much chance, a little bit of chance, but not that much chance to do it. But it was nice to see him again.
Can I do a quick attack on Stargate Science?
Absolutely.
Okay. There's nice little bits. Asgard's apparently have not evil, probably better sarcophagus tech. Like, we get that, which is like, who knows if we're going to ever see it. Yep. But hey, an Asgard ship comes up. Someone died recently. No problem. We can fix them.
Yeah.
I have no idea if the world building is going to touch that again. I think the ease in which the two Carters scienced up the power generator for the eighth Chevron dialing, super weak. They absolutely shouldn't have done that, and I expect that world building is going to be a pain for a while. That really, I have difficulty with that happening, especially considering how nicely the Nakoda reactor was built up and just ignored in the previous episode. That was good tech building. This was not.
Well, no, because what Major Carter learned in the last episode through working on the Nakoda generator helped her, they said in the script, you know, she has recently learned to do the Nakoda generator stuff, and that's what helped her to fix the Asgard turbo dialer thing.
I suppose it was still, I think, a mistake. Really, they just needed a place in our galaxy where they figured they knew Asgard would be. Like, that's all they needed. They didn't, like, in theory, they went to another galaxy, and it's like, overkill.
Yeah, you'd think they could have gone to the Thor planet in this one.
That's true.
Something like that. Like, it was unnecessary Stargate sciencing it up for what I think a bit of a weak bit of world building. And the other Stargate science I want to give up has to give you this quote. The increased entropy generated by both of us in the same reality might theoretically be causing a temporal distortion. What an excuse. It's like, they needed some stupid excuse why they had to go back, and it was a stupid excuse. I'm very sorry for whatever writer basically had to come up with that text, because it is garbage. Oh, well.
Well, speaking of Yeah.
Oh, well.
Speaking of Stargate and science, in when Apophis is meeting this Stargate team on his side, he says, you know, my first prime killed you before my very eyes. What magic is this? So interesting that Apophis, who knows there's no, or does he know there's no such thing as magic? Anyway, and how have you risen from the dead without a sarcophagus? He seems to jump to magic oddly easily for someone who should know it's, you know, for someone who plays a false god and knows that tech substitutes for magic.
The Goa'uld eat their own drink their own Kool-Aid.
Okay, so he knows?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's also like, Apophis knows there's no magic, but he's a big fan of drama, right? And what's more dramatic than saying, what magic is this? You know, you could, yeah. I think that's why he did that.
Okay. Also, another point. Hammond had said, whatever happens with this mission, once you're back, I want that quantum mirror destroyed. And we didn't see the mirror destroyed, but I can't remember any other episodes that reference it. Do you, Andrew? Or is that too spoilery for David? Should we leave him hanging?
I don't remember offhand either. If it's not like it's... Yeah. They may mention it in the future. It's probably a wiki thing to double check that. But but yeah, it's like it's not. Yeah, that's probably all we need to say about it. Yeah, I don't remember.
It's tricky because it's not a type of world building science tech that they can really do much. It's just this bizarre mirror toy, and I can imagine them just saying, "Okay, we're not going to keep doing this. We can't just." but I agree, destroying the tech is obviously a bad idea.
Oh, I'm always against destroying the tech. But then again, just leaving it unguarded and open in Area 51 was also probably a very bad idea.
I will say, just as a tease... But
it is a different kind of tech that you know, maybe they could learn some... You know, this is not a Stargate. It's a universe, an alternate universe gate. And it's interesting to wonder, you know, what if they had gone in that direction? And we're constantly stepping through to alternate Earths. Mm. Like Sliders!
Different show.
I was going to say, yeah.
Yes.
We had that show.
Yeah, I did like where Daniel was flipping through the universes and thought he had found the right one. But no, it was still Captain Carter instead of Major Carter.
Yes, another Major Carter joke.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. Another promotion joke. They've done that a couple of times. And we will see it again as well. Well, and the idea, you know, again, science-y thing, like the idea that in a system, in a physical system where every choice branches off and there could be minuscule differences between different universes and that you could tell by physically looking into the world that it's the exact right one also is hogwash. Scientifically, but yeah, again, fun dramatically, right? A fun dramatic thing.
Yeah, I've read a couple of stories, and in fact, I think there's a Sliders episode where somebody thinks they've made it back to the right universe, and it's only after they've been there for a while that they realize that something is off.
It's not quite right. And a few more things about the end of the episode. With that "love these guys, love those guys" reference from O'Neill.
Yes.
Like, and that's kind of all we get of their reaction. Like, you guys suck at ending scenes, you know? Like, they did that, like, the one from season two, right, where they're like, what did O'Neill say to Daniel when he came back? Like, Daniel's alive, and the best that he could come up with, like, you know, there's, like, one, like, monkey something or other. I don't remember what he said exactly. But, you know, they just don't – they can't do those dramatic ending emotional reaction scenes that well. So I still – yeah, they still can't. And then the last one was – the last thing in my notes is – no budget for little gray puppets.
Not this time.
Right? So we're not actually going to see the Asgard, despite them being the deus ex machina of this.
Which, to be fair, we've seen them do that before.
So, but we did see some cool shots. Yeah, their ship. Yeah. Well, we saw like their ship, right? We saw a couple, like they reused the shot of, you know, the pyramid ship coming down onto the mountain, Cheyenne Mountain. That's always a fun shot when they can use that again in yet another alternate universe episode. And then, of course, they reused probably the shots of the Asgard ships.
Yep.
That's always fun to see as well.
Yeah, I do think that Jack saying, "I love these guys," is kind of, it felt like what is it, hanging a lantern on the deus ex machina of how they wrap this episode.
The episode just, I think, is the reality is it's overstuffed, and it didn't really have enough space for a lot of what it was trying to do. So all of it just feels very rushed. And it's not a bad episode. It's just it's just very rough around the edges. It felt like a drop off of Learning Curve. Learning Curve had a good ending. This just seems generally a bit rushed, a bit fast. They had emotional beats and things they wanted to do, and the plot itself is almost immaterial.
Mm.
I did note that it is very lucky that Carter did not try to take O'Neill's name, because that would have screwed up the surprises and later in the story.
Oh, you mean like if she had been called Dr. O'Neill instead of Dr. Carter?
Exactly.
Ah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, and I also was intrigued by the fact that both women had never considered anything other than their professions. I would think that at least Carter would have felt some curiosity about just being, you know, a scientist, since she is a scientist, but a scientist for the Air Force. So you wonder, well, I wondered what the branching point was for how Dr. Carter never even thought about going into the military. I mean, agreed, yep. In this reality, Sam always wanted to please her father, so of course she went into the military. And that one, obviously, Samantha realized what a jerk her father was. I did not want to go into the military to become like him.
Both paths are realistic, though. Like, they both worked pretty well.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
When I think they had a kind of an endgame moment in here, and I won't go into it in more detail. I guess a spoiler for a movie that's been on a bunch of years now, where they had the moment where Dr. Carter was saying, we looked in all of these different timelines, and like, you're one of the only ones where you haven't been taken over.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That was probably the most interesting world-building moment, right? Where,
yes.
Oh, it was Daniel going through the mirror and finding this stuff out that let you survive when most Earths do not. That was fun, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah,
that was a fun moment.
Well, you can always believe that the TV show you're looking at is improbable, but it just happens to be you're looking at a very rare example of the one that worked, because the other stories were just too sad to write.
Yeah.
Right. Well, it,
I guess that does give some justification for Hammond's not wanting to mess around with any of these other alternate universes if they are mostly Gould controlled. Okay.
I just wanted to give you one quick call out to the writers knowing how silly their show is when O'Neill asks, what does Cree mean?
Oh. I liked that.
Yep.
Very.
But there are a lot of words in a lot of languages that do mean a lot of different things, depending on context. But yes, it was fun. You'd think he would have asked before, though, given how often they hear Jaffa Cree.
I think this episode also had this somewhat ridiculous scene where Mir Teal'c is just yelling it out to no one except himself in the hallway.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay. But they're willing to make fun of themselves for it. And I appreciate that. Kind of like, I like how O'Neill's willing to make fun of himself with the question, how could you marry such a loser?
Yep.
That was a fun little moment.
Mm-hmm.
It was a bonding moment, right? It wasn't just like him making, I don't know, that was a really nice, nuanced moment.
Well, there's also a lot of, well, at least attempted humor in the next episode. Andrew, you want to tell us about Dead Man Switch?
Oh, God. Yeah, I can do that. Okay. So, SG-1 travels to another forest planet and falls into an obvious trap set by the famous bounty hunter Aris Bok, who is hunting a Tok'ra named Korra, who is, alas, not the Avatar, on behalf of the Goa'uld system lord, Sokar. Bok's race was mostly wiped out by the Goa'uld, with the remainder now dependent for their lives on a chemical called Roshna. Teal'c offers to go with Bok instead of Korra. In the end, Teal'c has a whole scene where he gets to talk and convince Bok to turn against the Goa'uld and free him. I guess the Roshna wasn't that big of a problem after all. The end.
Wow.
Yep. Let's see. So, right, I was calling it early in the episode when Aris Bok was telling the team, get me Kel'tar which was his name for Korra, and I will let you all go. And Jack took the deal, and I was saying, what if Keltar is Tok'ra? And yes, of course, it turned out that that was.
Yep. Yep.
Let's see. I was annoyed when Jack saw Eris Bak going for the door that was holding the other Carter and Teal'c inside. And he had seen before that there was a combination on that door. He knew that they needed that combination. They had, their earlier plan to escape had failed because of not having it. And he turned away as Eris Bak started entering the door combination again. And I just thought that was, what are you doing? Let's see, another thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I need to look up the episode of Deep Space Nine where Dr. Bashir found out that the fearsome Jem'Hadar who served the changelings were enslaved to the changelings by their own drug addiction. I need to figure out which year was which.
Yep.
Let's see. Did anything else really strike me in that episode? Like I said, there was a lot of self-deprecation.
A lot of humor in this episode. There was a lot of, you know, just talking because they were prisoners of Eris Bak for the good portion of this episode, right? So there's a lot of back and forth and a lot of ways that they kind of kept that light. Yeah.
Right. A lot of ego.
Because they were, you know, they were insulting him and he was kind of insulting them right back.
Yeah.
You know, Eris Bak at one point says, my word is good on over 2,000 planets. And O'Neill says, there are billions. Right. I thought that was a fun way of kind of insulting him a little bit.
I'm still sort of caught up.
But it's also like, it's just, it, yeah.
I'm still sort of caught up as on why the Goa'uld would be hiring bounty hunters.
Go ahead.
That just sounds dumb.
Yeah, right. I do think someone, like one of my notes says, someone wrote Galactic Bounty Hunter on a whiteboard at some point as the linchpin of this episode. Like, this show has not had sort of a Star Wars-esque galactic commerce and all sorts of different traffic going on between the planets. And that makes sense, right? Because Stargates are not big enough to have planetary traffic. I think we've talked about this before, right? You can't do it. You need ships. You need something else to do this. So whenever they sort of dip into this other kind of world that they want to sometimes write episodes about, it never quite seems to fit with the world, the galaxy as they originally described it. But, you know, somebody wanted Galactic Bounty Hunter as the premise of this episode, and they just made it fit well enough to go ahead with it. Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds a bit, it sounds really weak because this galaxy is basically shoehorned into being entirely little hamlets that are all separated by a Roman Empire that's hopefully crumbling soon of the Goa'uld. Like, that just sounds weird.
Okay, I looked it up on my phone. Ketracel White, the Jem'Hadar drug, the episode I'm thinking of was called Hippocratic Oath, and that aired in 1995. So that would have been...
Oh, plenty of time.
Before this,
yep.
Yes.
Yep. And this is what it feels like.
An homage or a theft or whatever.
Right, it did actually remind me of Ketracel White in the way that it was presented. So I do think, that works. But it's also like he kind of says at one point, oh, I have a wife and kid and like my kid's in the mines. And then they kind of never come back to that. It just seems like, you know, there were more chances for this to be a more emotionally wrought episode that they didn't go with. And I think some of it is, again, talk about why, what did they concentrate on? Well, one, they said Galactic Bounty Hunter. But two, I think scene with Teal'c at the end. Again, he talks more than he has talked in many other episodes.
Hooray for Christopher Judge.
Just to, you know, to say stuff. He gets a scene.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was sort of supposed to be the emotional heart of this episode where he gets a chance to change this guy's thought. And it was fun to see that and fun to sort of talk a little more. But it's also like you're changing this bounty hunter's whole life choice in like a 5-minute conversation. You know?
Yeah.
How?
I also thought it was a bit inconsistent. Korra the Tok'ra had said this bounty hunter doesn't have a son. It's just the drug. But Eris Bak did seem pretty determined on building up some big price. Is he just trying to get enough credit to get a lifetime supply of the Roshna? Or
oh, okay. Yeah.
Does he have some vulnerable hostages? Right. Or what? We don't know. Or I didn't figure it out anyway. But I did like that he handed a vial of Roshna to Carter at the end. You know, maybe your scientists can figure this out and free my people or something.
Yep.
But I think I'm about out of things that I wanted to say about this episode. anything else from you?
Another last bit, yeah. So Korra makes a big deal about the fact that if he's taken by the Gould, he will have to reveal secrets because they know ways of getting information out of him.
Mm-hmm.
But Teal'c volunteering himself when he knows so much about SGC security and procedures also makes no sense. So, okay, that was my last little quibble from this episode.
Yeah, I think Teal'c was planning to, A, convince the bounty hunter to convert.
Yeah.
Or, B, if worst came to worst, he wasn't restrained. He could reach over and fight for the controls and maybe crash into the Gould ship or, you know, find some way to get himself killed. I'm fully confident that Teal'c was not planning to actually surrender himself to Sokar.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Okay, cool.
All right. Season 3, Episode 8, Demons. Stargate team comes through the gate, and guess what? The people there figure they are demons. Because they came through the Circle of Darkness. Right, so once again, we're in a forest planet. They see what looks like a church in the distance and comment on how this is the first sign of Christianity they've seen in hundreds of missions. Daniel theorizes that they're taken from medieval Europe. Teal'c says he has read the Bible because it's a significant part of your Western culture. Right, so people flee when they enter the village, except for this woman who can't because she's chained up. A terrified man comes out holding a cross, asking them to spare her. It turns out that she's been chained up because it looks like she's unclean because she has the chicken pox. They eventually heal her after this man Simon is set up to do a trepanning ritual, which will let the bad demons out of her. Anyway, this society is one where an Unas comes at regular intervals to pick up sacrifices who the religious leader, the canon, has picked out to be the sacrifices and be taken off for Gould service or becoming hosts. Lots of arguments, but they decide that Teal'c has to go through some tests because he's obviously unclean, but they want to prove it before they kill him. And when, you know, the second test that they give him is throwing him into a pond and seeing if he stays down, in which case he's innocent and clean, or if he comes back to the surface, in which case he's obviously a demon and needs to be killed. That good old medieval catch 22. And so he doesn't come up. Everyone thinks he's dead. The canon says, okay, the rest of you can go. And as they're going and trying to convince Simon to bury the gate and stuff like that, Teal'c rises from the dead. He wasn't dead. The symbiote took oxygen from the water in the pond where he was drowned and kept him alive. Teal'c, knowing that he was going to be thrown in the water, had put himself into that Jaffa trance, Kelnarine, or whatever it is. Anyway, eventually they decide to sacrifice the whole team after all. The Unas comes and is leading them off in a chain and leads them along the ridge of a hill, and they all throw themselves down the hillside and temporarily escape. Simon comes back up. The Unas catches him. Simon shoots the Unas and takes off running, and the Unas catches him. Meanwhile, the team picks up the staff and gets themselves free, and they come over to where Simon had been met by both the canon and the Unas, and the canon says, well, the Unas has dropped dead. The canon says, Simon really put himself before the demon like Daniel. He's great. I've been wrong. I'm so sorry. Y'all go. And here's the ring. Fine. I'll surrender the ring. Carter realizes that the Gould had actually gone into the canon. Jack shoots the canon. Simon agrees that they'll bury the Stargate right away after you leave. The end.
Huh. I'm pretty good at not watching these two episodes.
Yes.
Yeah, I think the one twist that I think I didn't see the first time, and of course it's hard to remember, was the gold from the Unas going into the cannon instead. Mm-hmm. Thought that was actually a decent twist for episodes like this, for genre episodes like this.
Mm-hmm.
And they even, they lampshaded it a bit by, you don't see how the Unas dies.
He's right.
He's going to attack the cannon and then he dies off screen. So yeah, that was kind of the only real surprise. Like the idea that Tilk was going to come back was never in doubt.
Right.
And they spent so many minutes on, the women washing his body. And I was like, come on, just wake up already. it felt natural that he said, I was in Kel-Narim. Like, yeah, sure. If you are breathing so seldom because you're in this deep Kel-Narim, you could probably be underwater. Well, even without that whole thing of like pulling in oxygen from the water, even without that, you could probably have survived a long time. What's funny with the witch stuff, again, the ways they were treating Teal'c, like treating him like a witch, that might have seemed like overwriting, like crazy, making up stuff about the Middle Ages. That's all true, right? In fact, how they actually dealt with witches. Like, you couldn't win, right, if somebody accused you of being a witch. You either had to die by drowning, or you were a witch and they would kill you. And that's how it was for a good long time out there. So
you can drown and they say, oh, you were good after all. It's God's will. Or you don't die and they say, a witch, burn her. Just how it was. Very, very much catch 22. Let's see, was there anything else? There certainly wasn't much worth talking about. Oh, Jack is surprised to see an Unas because for some reason he thought that the Unas they encountered before was the only one because it's called Unas and that sounds like Uno and that means one, right?
Right.
And Daniel says, no, Jack.
Yeah. That was like the one fun bit of world building, right?
Right.
The Unas is a species. I don't know how much we've talked about Sokar so far.
Oh, yeah, that's the other thing I wanted to mention. So it turns out that this Unas works for Sokar. So that's the second mention of Sokar that we've had. So maybe he's the big bad for this season. I don't remember.
Did we do the thing where he wanted a Papus back, right? That was another episode that we had.
He was the face in the start in the Iris, wasn't he?
Where he did that. Yeah.
Yep.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, that was him. Okay. So now we get...
Oh, he's the one who wanted to take Apophis off and torture him and revive him and torture him some more.
So very devilish, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now we find out that he's posing as the devil, and that's a little bit more information about him.
Right. That is a fun little twist, that instead of posing as a god for these people, he's just posing as the devil.
Close enough.
Yeah.
Easier to keep up, I suppose.
Yep. Again, one of the differences between, episodes like these and sort of the better SG-1 episodes are that this one didn't quite have the nuance. It didn't have those moments. It's a fairly slow episode, right? There wasn't that much that happened. They got time with these characters, and yet it didn't really matter that much. Like, we had that one scene with the cannon where he's kind of talking with SG-1 and saying, it's my responsibility to keep all these people alive.
Mm-hmm.
It's my responsibility. I have to make these sacrifices so that people will live.
Right.
We can't fight this Unas. And that's actually can be a relatively nuanced thing. Like, he could be a power-hungry person, but also doing this for the sake, but also be the only thing keeping these people alive, which was actually true. But instead, they kind of make him a cartoon villain at the end.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really take advantage of the fact that this could have been a much more interesting situation than they kind of let it be.
Yeah, it certainly could have been more nuanced. Not terribly surprising that it isn't, but we don't see what kind of awful person he is aside from just the power, he may be.
Well, he threatens the one guy. Yeah.
Ruling the people here he threatens the one guy who had dared to question his authority. But we don't know what else, other pressures he's putting on people. We don't know. But I didn't really mind his cartoonishness. I wouldn't really have expected much else from this episode.
Yeah. So, and we won't get into the fact that basically you can't really just have one village, right? Like, that doesn't work civilization-wise.
Oh, yeah, that does not work Why bother to set up a Stargate for one village for five people every what is it, every couple of years or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, didn't make sense.
You could argue that maybe he was actually visiting a whole bunch of other villages, which were just didn't know about each other. But that's already, as I've said before, thinking more about this than the writers of this episode did, so I'm going to stop.
Yeah.
I don't mind generally the idea in Stargate where the Gold generally want to keep the population in all these little places down and small.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the Stargates were never designed for this state of the galaxy as it is, and we're just, and this is just like post-apocalyptic Stargate travel.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I did like that there was one other person in the village who questioned things. There was some old man who mentioned to Simon, you know, if these people are demons, why is the demon hurting his own, he said. And I did like that Simon, the religious person, turned out to be a good guy. He was sincere in his faith. He said, my God is always with me. He said prayers for the dead. You know, he was not a cartoonish, dumb believer. He, obviously had strong faith, and he was portrayed as strong through his faith. And I like that they didn't just make him a dummy because he was religious.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I think that's about all I have. So, two good episodes with a lot worth talking about. Two so-so episodes with not much worth talking about. I don't remember what we have coming up next.
Rules of Engagement and Forever in a Day.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And a shallow dive on past and present.
Mm-hmm.
But this one I get to watch.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Well, as always, I've enjoyed this discussion.
And I think, so we've done a lot of these things where we kind of talked about a variety of different addresses. I think from this point on, we can kind of just say, well, we have our own standalone website, sgfund.space. That you can go to and, you know, find out our Mastodon address and all of the ways to reach us and, you know, you can get to all of the episodes and things. So that just go to sgfund.space. If you want to listen to old episodes, do anything about our show here, that's where you need to look.
Right. Contact us on social media. If you want to maybe, be a guest on our show at some point and talk about some episodes with us. Or if you just have thoughts you want to share with us about the show, most of us still do hang out on the Incomparable Discord, even though this show is no longer associated with the Incomparable.
Right.
So you can find us there, or as Andrew says, through sgfund.space. So, until next time.
Bye-bye.
Yep. See you later.